Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
Okay, welcome back. It's our custom to go around the room and say our names. My name is Grisha.
Alex.
Luis.
My name is Henry.
I'm Jim.
David.
My name is Jerry.
Stephen.
Matthew.
I'm Brad.
I'm George.
My name is Kat.
My name is Jeff.
I'm Richard.
I'm Ron.
Oh,
and
Jerry.
And then I'll also just say hello. We can wave to the iPad to our friends online. We have Bob and Tom, Daniel, Ryan, Timothy, Richard, Joe, John, Sam, and another Tom. So welcome everyone. And I'll introduce our teacher for today. Dhammachari Gandhidasa has been practicing with the San Francisco Buddhist Center community, so we have our shrine room here, since 1993 and was ordained in 2011. His current area of exploration is the cultivation of metta, universal loving kindness, as a response to all the hatred, discrimination, and bigotry in the world out there. So, welcome, Gandhidasa.
Hi everyone, my name is Dhammadasa. Really just lovely to be here. It's actually always a little delight to come here and be with all of you here. So the title of my talk, since I know you post these talks online and you know, there is always the burden of naming the talk, so I figured I'd go ahead and name this talk. And I shall name it Opening the Heart. Opening the Heart. And maybe I'll just say something about this particular theme of opening the heart. I actually relate to Buddhist practice as simply a process of opening the heart. There are many ways to frame Buddhist practice, but I'll just frame it in this particular way today, opening the heart. And the interesting thing about opening the heart is when we open our hearts, we open our hearts to the entire breadth of our experience, to our greatest joys and our deepest griefs as well. We open our heart to all. So I would like to begin by reading this poem. And Grisha, if you could please screen share this poem, just the poem part first. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to read this poem twice, and I'll read it quite slowly so that we'll all have an opportunity just to take the words in more deeply into our hearts. So you might think of this as a little mini meditation. I will not die an unlived life. I will not live in fear of falling or catching fire. I choose to inhabit my days, to allow my living to open me, to make me less afraid, more accessible, to loosen my heart until it becomes a wing, a torch, a promise. I choose to risk my significance, to live so that that which came to me as seed goes to the next as blossom, and that which came to me as blossom goes on as fruit. I will not die an unlived life. I will not live in fear of falling or catching fire. I choose to inhabit my days, to allow my living to open me, to make me less afraid, more accessible, to loosen my heart until it becomes a wing, a torch, a promise. I choose to risk my significance, to live so that which came to me as seed goes to the next as blossom, and that which came to me as blossom goes on as fruit. Yeah, so I'd like to invite three or four people, if there's any line or image from this poem that that moved you, and you'd like to share about what line or image that was and why it moved you. Maybe we can have like three-ish people here in the room, and maybe one or two people from Zoom. Jeff?
Yeah, really, the line, I choose to risk my significance, really, stunning in a way, and if, I'd like to talk more about that. I mean, I don't know what that means exactly, but it could mean a lot of things in terms of, you know, who I think I am, what am I, what's significant.
Any other shares?
I like the first line, I will not die an unlived life. Echoes a lot of the poetry of Mary Oliver, who phrases those things, and it really just resonates with me. Particularly her last line of a woman, when death comes, I don't want to merely have visited this world. Amen.
I read this poem about 17 years ago, and it was a big inspiration for me. I put it on my desk and so I can see it. And looking back, maybe I was, last 17 years, was trying to live my life. And it seems like it keeps unfolding on deeper and deeper level. And I still have that fear of falling that I'm trying to let go. But I see that over 17 years I moved along the way, which gives me a hope that maybe by the end of the life I will say, yes, I did.
Thank you. Any shares on Zoom?
Yes. Go ahead, Richard.
Hi, I'm Richard. The line that most spoke to me was about what comes to me as seed goes on as blossom, and to the next as blossom, and that which came to me as blossom goes on as fruit, of doing the best I can to be productive with my life and blossom with my life as offering to others. I thought that really struck me a lot.
Thank you, Richard. Any other shares from Zoom?
I don't see any hands.
Yeah, I know when I'm on Zoom and that question arises, any shares, I seem to wait till the very last second for my hand up. So, last chance.
Okay.
Oh, please.
In the paper today, there was, I noticed that a woman who had was fleeing Lahaina and had to run through flames, and they worked for 7 weeks to save her life, and she just died. Mm-hmm. And full body burns are just beyond painful. Mm-hmm. I don't mean to detour the conversation, but she did not fear catching fire. She, you know. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's what. But it's a gorgeous poem. Thank you for sharing it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, that's quite a powerful image. When I read poetry, I rarely receive the images literally. So it's quite eye-opening for me to hear you share a literal image of someone on fire. It's quite a poignant image. And so thank you for that. Okay, so no more hands, huh? All right. So now I'd like to invite us all to turn your attention to this image. So if you could scroll up. So this image, both this poem and this image are very alive for me in the current chapter of my journey. And this image here is my own creation of what is called the Diamond Throne, or the Vajrasana. So just to be clear, I did not design this image, but rather I found two digital images online of the meditating figure and the Tree of Life. For the sake of the audio recording, I'd like to just describe this image. So in the center of this image, there's a drawing of a meditating human, and overlaid upon their body are the seven chakras, the seven energy centers. And the backdrop of this meditating figure is this sort of cosmic image of the sky with stars. It's more like an image of space. And then beneath the image, protruding from the bottom root chakra, are the roots of a tree. And then above the image, protruding from the crown chakra, is the trunk of the tree with a canopy of leaves. So this is the image that we are all looking at here. And this term Vajrasana, Vajra, and this is it's a Pali word. Vajrasana is a Pali word, and Pali is a language from ancient India. And it's the language which was used to write down all the teachings of the Buddha. And Vajra means diamond, and Sana, Vajrasana. Sana means seat. So the translation of Vajrasana means the diamond throne. So if you were to Google this word, Vajrasana, what would come up is the seat upon which the historical Buddha gained enlightenment. So this place, this physical place, it's in northern India, in a town called Bodh Gaya, in a place what is known now as the Mahabodhi Temple. And I had the great honor and privilege of doing a Buddhist pilgrimage back in January of 2020, and I went to Bodh Gaya, and for me it was an incredibly powerful experience. The Mahabodhi Temple, it is the penultimate Buddhist pilgrimage site. So there are Buddhists from all over the world coming to this place to pay their respects and show their reverence and devotion towards the Buddha. And so the Buddha became enlightened under what is now called the Bodhi Tree. So you can go there and you can circumambulate the Bodhi tree, and you can also sit beside this stone bench, the diamond throne, where it said that the Buddha gained enlightenment. So that's the literal meaning of Vajrasana. And there's also a poetic meaning as well to this word, because in the Buddhist tradition, it's also said that all Buddhas of past have gotten enlightened in this same spot on the Vajrasana, and all Buddhas of future times will also become enlightened upon this seat, the Vajrasana. So if you were to take this notion literally, it's like, well, that makes no sense whatsoever. To get enlightened, I have to go to India? It's like, sit on that seat? Well, there's a big fence around it. They would arrest me if I tried to go sit there. That's crazy, right? So it's not to be taken literally. So poetically, Vajrasana, this notion that all Buddhas become enlightened in the same place, the Vajrasana is here, It's our very own breathing bodies. So we each carry with us our diamond thrones. So when we are fully embodied, when we fully inhabit our diamond thrones, this is the place where we can experience a sense of deep calm, stillness, and peace, a sense of deep mental and emotional stability and equanimity. This is a place where we can experience a deep sense of belonging, deep sense of home. This is also the place where we can experience a deep sense of clarity, clarity about what it is that we must do, we each individually must do. And also we can experience a sense of inspired energy, creative energy, to joyfully do that which we need to do. So this is the Vajrasana, this very breathing body. And for me, this image, it poetically captures the meaning of Vajrasana. So in terms of images, in terms of symbols, for a symbol to be sacred, a sacred image, a sacred image is a doorway into the deep mysteries. Enlightenment is a deep mystery. It's not something that can be understood with the cognitive mind. It's not something that can be described. It's only something that can be experienced. And one simply knows. That's all that can be said about it. So for an image to be a sacred image, the image has to always be out in front. We can never actually fully understand an image, because in fact an image is simply a doorway into the deep mysteries. So even this image of a doorway, I think, is quite powerful, where a doorway, so imagine standing before a doorway and opening the door and walking through it. And what do you see? You see what you see, but you no longer see the door. You no longer see the doorway because it's now behind you. So there's even something quite mysterious about that image of a doorway. So, this line, the second and third lines of this poem, I will not live in fear of falling or catching fire. I'll just read a couple more lines too. I will not live in fear of falling or catching fire. I choose to inhabit my days, to allow my living to open me, to make me less afraid, more accessible, to loosen my heart until it becomes a wing, a torch, a promise. So I'd like to say something about my own journey that is reflected within this image. And it's not just my journey. I think there's something quite universal about what I'm about to describe, because I know many people relate to what I'm saying. So I'm just going to take this image and I'm going to fold it so that you can no longer see the roots of the tree. You can only see the meditating figure with the tree protruding from the crown chakra in the canopy of the trees. So I've been practicing now for... thank you, Grisha. That's very well done with the screenshot. Yeah, perfect, yeah. That was completely unrehearsed. Well done. Yeah, so I've been practicing Buddhism now for 30 years, and for 27 of those 30 years, this is how my practice looked. There were no roots, or the roots remained unseen, and I paid no attention to them. All I paid attention to was that which was visible, you know, the canopy, the branches of the tree. And I think actually this is very, very common. Actually, I believe that this is the starting point upon which we embark on this journey of personal transformation towards liberation. So let me say something about why I say this is universal, why I think this is universal. So we humans, we are deeply, deeply conditioned to chase after what we believe is pleasant. And if we don't chase after them, we're deeply, deeply conditioned just to crave after what we believe is pleasant, regardless of whether we go chasing after it. Right? Similarly, we're deeply conditioned to look away from what we think and what we consider to be unpleasant, what we consider to be painful. This is just the human condition. So as a result, what we see is actually limited to our own preferences. And sure, we see things that are painful. You know, there are times in our lives where we have no choice, where painful events happen that are unavoidable. We simply cannot look away. For instance, the death of a loved one. That's something that we simply cannot look away from. Or our own mortality. You know, if one were to receive a diagnosis of a terminal disease, for example, that's something that we simply cannot look away from. But we like to not think about those things as a culture. We not like to not think about death. But rather, we like to think about things like wisdom and patience, peace and compassion, inspired creative energy. In other words, we're conditioned to actually journey towards the light, the visible, the fruits of practice. And this is exactly what I did for 27 years. And there are wonderful fruits that I have received during that journey of 27 years. And then something happened about 3 years ago, a little over 3 years ago. For me personally, it was the murder of George Floyd. That's what completely shifted the scope of my practice, if you will. So when George Floyd was murdered, I was awakened from my racialized slumber. And that began a very eye-opening and very painful journey, actually, that continues on. So I very much relate to these past 3 years, as I have definitely traversed through a dark night of the soul. And that journey has yielded incredible fruits, actually. So in terms of a dark night of the soul, my practice shifted to this. So now I'm going to unfold this drawing again. And I'll increase it above the crown chakra, this meditating body. So now all you can see is the meditating figure with the roots protruding down from the root chakra of this meditating figure. So during this time, the past 3 years, I have had to, really, I had no choice. When a dark night of the soul arrives, we have no choice. Because it's a situation where to avoid is actually more painful than turning towards what needs to be turned towards. And of course, I'm going to choose the less painful option, which was still pretty painful, right? So I turned towards grief, very deep grief, very deep sorrow, very deep frustration. I turned towards my experience of anger, which was an incredible journey, actually. So before George Floyd was murdered, when I was only journeying towards the light, one of the notions that I unconsciously received around Buddhist practice is that good Buddhists don't get angry. No? Anger is a sign of, you know, oh, that's unskillful. You know? Exactly, Jeff. Well, let's all get along here. And so, you know, when George Floyd got murdered, that really angered me. And I didn't know what to do with that anger. It's like, oh, well, this seems like a perfectly reasonable thing to be really angry about. But then, you know, my own conditioning was like, oh, no, good Buddhists don't get angry. And that was also my childhood conditioning as well. Like, you know, don't cry, don't show emotion. You know, that just will give your enemies something to, you know, attack you with in the future. Yeah. But I allowed myself to get angry. I gave myself permission to get angry. And actually, as many of you know, I have 26-year-old twins. And they came to mind. My experience of parenting came to mind. You know, so I remember when they were small, you know, kids get angry. And as a parent, you have to not take it personally, right? Like, if a small infant tells you, it's like, I hate you, I hate you. You know, like, oh, my God, my kids hate me. No. We know not to take that personally. But as adults, we lose track of that. You know, so if somebody gets angry at us, we have a tendency to take it personally, and it hurts. And then because it hurts, well, then we have a tendency to either fight, flight, or freeze. And when we're immersed in, or when we're overcome with flight or freeze, we're no longer seeing clearly. We're actually no longer looking. We're just defending. You know, this is outside my comfort zone, and I am now turning away. I am checking out. Fight, flight, or freeze. So maybe I'll say a bit about this dance with anger. And a very influential book that I read was around anger, was by a black American Buddhist by the name of Lama Ra Owens. And he wrote a book called Love and Rage, something like Taking Anger as a Path of Transformation, something like that. And as a black American, he has a lifetime of this dance with anger. For me, it's only been 3 years, because I was asleep prior to the murder of George Floyd. And just to hear someone speak so fluently about this dance with anger and this path of anger as a path of transformation was so incredibly eye-opening for me. So just this, like, executive summary of what I received from Lama Ra. Well, the first thing I received from him was I listened to him speak, like, I can read books, but really I need to hear people's voices. I need to see them and hear them speaking. And he self-described himself as a bad Buddhist because he gets angry. And I was like, heck yeah, I'm going to be a bad Buddhist too. And what he taught me was that, well, anger, it's just when we feel unsafe. And that's the best we can do. To say, whatever's happening right now, it's just simply too much for my heart to bear. And the best I can do is just to get angry about it. This is exactly what small children do. You know, that's the best they can do. They just throw a temper tantrum. They're not getting what they want. And Lama Ra just asks us to investigate this experience of anger. Well, you're feeling unsafe. Well, what are those unmet needs? And are those unmet needs worthy of attention? And are they worthy of fighting for? Are they worthy of actually being angry about? And I quickly saw that I had an unmet need in certain relationships to be treated with dignity and respect. And I was not receiving that in some very important relationships. So then there was a whole process of, okay, well, clearly I'm not having those needs met over here, which was heartbreaking, actually, frustrating, all sorts of stuff. And there was a turning towards, well, where can I get these needs met? Because I need to really take care of myself here in this situation that I was facing. So this dark night of the soul, we also receive great gifts from taking this journey down into the underworld. There's an image of wisdom descending from above. And there's another image of wisdom arising from below. So these two journeys, this upward journey up towards the heavens, and I do mean this poetically, this journey up towards the heavens, and this journey down into the underworld, these two journeys have very different rhythms. So the journey upwards towards the heavens, this tends to be characterized by it tends to be dominated, or what's very central to this journey upwards towards the heavens is the sense of productivity. Okay, well, this is me, this is where I'm at, and oh, look, I would really appreciate it if I were more patient, if I were more compassionate, if I were just wiser, if I could just be, you know, more accepting of the way things are. So the sense of, here's where I am now, here's where I'd like to be. And then this productivity of like, okay, well, how am I going to get from point A to point B? Okay, well, I think I should meditate, maybe I'll, you know, come to Sangha gatherings and make friends with other Buddhists and maybe I'll go on retreat. And then here come the action items. And there's a sense of, I'm doing this to get that. And actually, it does work. It really works. Yeah. So that's the rhythm of the journey upwards towards the light. And if one is also not journeying downwards into the underworld, then one's practice has no roots. One can never be certain of where one stands. So the rhythm of this journey downwards into the underworld, it's very, very mysterious. And what happens really operates outside of time. There is no time frame. There is no doing. You can certainly try and do down there, but it's not going to get you anywhere. One just simply needs to receive. One just simply needs to become receptive to these aspects of our experience that we tend to avoid, tend to ignore, tend to push away out to the periphery of our consciousness. So anyone who has lost a loved one, a beloved person in your life, will know the journey of grief. And I personally think that grief actually never ends. The journey with grief never ends. We simply receive the fruits of turning towards grief and being with grief. And it is a very mysterious process. And it happens in its own time frame. It cannot be forced. It cannot be rushed. It cannot really even be understood. We just simply need to enter into a space of a very deep listening and very deep receptivity. So another thing that I've learned about this journey downwards into the underworld, this dark night of the soul, it's very much this process of cultivating emotional resilience. So there's only so much heartache that a tender heart can take on at any given time, you know. The old saying of, hey, if it's too hot in the kitchen, you know, get out of the kitchen, yeah. But don't just avoid it altogether. So this journey downwards into to grief, to sorrow, to frustration and loss, it became a practice for me where I would meditate. I would do these meditation sessions where I would very intentionally just open myself up to the experience of grief and sorrow and bear what I could bear. And then, okay, that's enough. Got to go do something else. And the image of like going to the gym or exercising comes to mind. You know? You don't just leap off the couch and go run a marathon. You build up gradually. One builds up strength gradually. And this is the nature of cultivating emotional resilience, the ability to turn towards these very painful aspects of our lives. We can do it a little bit at the beginning, that's enough. And every time we do it, we get a little more comfortable with it, or we can bear more, or the emotional resilience begins to develop in our hearts. So I have experienced this quite strongly. And there is this incredible inner strength, this wellspring of inner strength that flows from the arising of emotional resilience. And I won't use the word of cultivation of emotional resilience, but rather this whole process of just simply receiving emotional resilience. So it's an absolutely wonderful, mysterious, and painful journey downwards. So in that midnight hour, this dark night of the soul, oh my God, this is just too dark. I need to cultivate joy here. There's not enough joy here. It's like, what it's like if you live by one of the poles and it's like dark 24 hours and for months on end. It's like, I don't know if I can do that. But so then, now I'm going to take this drawing and I'm just going to unfold it once again. So now this drawing now shows both the roots protruding downwards from the root chakra, as well as the trunk and the canopy protruding upwards from the crown chakra. And I began very actively and intentionally both turning towards grief and sorrow and also cultivating joy. And that really I could feel as this practice of cultivating joy really began to, you know, gain some momentum. Yeah. Practice, it's all about repetition. Just repetition, repetition, repetition. And every time we do something, we receive a little more of the fruit, you know, a little more of the juice. And I could feel that, okay, yeah, things are on an upward trend. Things are on an upward trend. And I'll share the final chapter, which will bring me right into the present of my own journey, is about 3 weeks ago, I did a trip to England. And this particular Buddhist community, this Buddhist community that's associated with this place, the San Francisco Buddhist Center. So I'm ordained within this tradition. It's called the Tri Ratna Buddhist Order. And the Tri Ratna Buddhist Order was actually founded in London. So in London and England and the UK, there is, there's a tremendous amount of Tri Ratna activity, order members, centers, and retreat centers and whatnot. So I went to England for a three-week trip. And my three-week trip, it actually began with a week-long people of color retreat. And I had never been on a people of color retreat before, in any context. And it was transformative, absolutely transformative. So maybe I'll just say this one thing about that experience is I laughed more in those 7 days than I have in the past 3 years. Yeah, it was profound. So I would say that before that trip, I felt quite exhausted and isolated. And after that trip, I now feel deeply nourished. Deeply inspired. And I feel connected with this network of care that is actually primarily with this London-based people of color sangha within them. And it's all part of Tri Ratna. So it's just one of the little groupings within Tri Ratna, if you will. Yeah. So this poem, I will not live in fear of falling or catching fire. So I love this line because it has this sense of falling down. I will not live in fear of falling down into the underworld. And I will not live in fear of catching fire. This is the image of Icarus, who flew too close to the sun and caught fire. I choose to inhabit my days. I love this word, inhabit. There's something just so juicy about this word, inhabit. You know, so habit, like habitat, one's home. You know, and to actually really inhabit one's home. And this is our home. It's our breathing bodies. So I very much imagine the Buddha to be at home in his breathing body, which means he's completely at ease at all times and under all conditions. So the happiness of the Buddha is completely independent of external conditions. It's even completely independent of his own health. Yeah, it's quite striking. I choose to inhabit my days, to allow my living to open me. So this experience of opening the heart, open to both the joys and the sorrows. So going back to my three-week trip to England, during this week-long people of color retreat, I just experienced these new heights of joy. It's just, I was basking in love, just receiving, receiving, receiving. It was just, for those of you who've been on retreat before, you know, like the day before the retreat ends and the mind sort of turns towards life after retreat. So on that last day, I noticed that was happening with my mind. And I kind of noticed over here on this end of the spectrum, this new layer of grief, this deeper layer of grief that was also present. And I noticed that my heart could hold it. My heart could hold both these new heights of beautiful joy and love, as well as this new depth of grief. And it just felt so good, actually. That's what an open heart, an opening of the heart, actually feels like. To allow my living to open me, to make me less afraid, more accessible. So I do feel more accessible. You know, there's something about before this 3-week trip, you know, when one is exhausted, one's ability to give is in direct relationship to one's ability to receive. So I have become far more skilled at self-care as well as receiving care from others. And without that, I can't give. Or what I give is just an empty shell. So I do feel more accessible. To make me less afraid, more accessible, to loosen my heart until it becomes a wing, a torch, a promise. I choose to risk my significance. So Jeff, you named that line really struck out, you know, struck you. And also it's like, I'm not quite sure what that means. And there's something very beautiful about that, to actually not know what it means. And here's something I like to do as well. It's just a little practice. When you come across something, I choose to risk my significance, which just, you know, I put in this category of like, wow, that feels really important. And I have no idea what it means. And I remember it's these like these little secrets, you know, these little treasures that they're contained within these locked boxes. And sometimes these little mysteries will be in the back of my mind for months, years sometimes. And at some point, oh, of course, that's what that means. And when that arises, I like to do this. Thank you. Thank you. And take that answer, set it to the side, and just ask again, what else is there? What else am I not seeing? And that just grounds my attention, my consciousness, my focus upon the mysteries. Because I think it's very dangerous to think we know all the answers. Oh, I've got this sorted. Thank you very much. Don't be so sure. Don't be so sure. I choose to risk my significance, to live so that which came to me as seed goes to the next as blossom. And that which came to me as blossom goes on as fruit. Yeah. Okay, so I think I shall conclude with that. So thank you all for your kind attention.
All right, thank you. Let's see, what are our announcements? We'll hear from the host today.
I am your host today. Please stay and enjoy the company of the Sangha. There are mandolins and mandarin oranges out there for you to enjoy. If you have tea, just leave your cup in the sink and I will take care of it. I'll be coming around with the Donna Bowl. And we have a suggested donation of $10 to $20. The help meets the Sangha expenses, including the honorarium for our Dharma speakers, rent on this beautiful center, and our quarterly newsletter, which is now mostly people who are incarcerated. There's a sign-up sheet on the credenza to get on our mailing list. Excuse me, if some members meet for lunch at 12:30, and if you're doing that, you might consider inviting someone to join you. Thank you.
Any other announcements? Next week, J.D. Doyle, who serves as core teacher at the East Bay Meditation Center and has served as a board member and was the co-founder of LGBTQI Meditation Group. J.D. is in spirit, the Spirit Rock Meditation Center teacher training program and was the dedicated practitioner program and the community Dharma leader program. J.D. has practiced Buddhism since 1995 in the U.S., Thailand, and Burma. You can read the rest of her bio online. And so if there are no other announcements, we will close with a dedication of merit. Do you have one, or would you like us to do that? By the power and truth of this practice, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all beings be free from sorrow and the causes of sorrow. May all never be separated from the sacred happiness which is without sorrow, and may all live in equanimity without too much attachment or too much aversion, believing in the equality of all that lives.
Thanks, Alan.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.